From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the cool harmonies and synchronized dance steps of the Temptations. Otis Williams tells us how he founded the Motown supergroup and kept it together for more than 25 years. Also today, new stories about America's new immigrants. I speak with Bharati Mukherjee, an Indian-American writer who describes living in two cultures at once. And we have reviews of the new albums from Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis and of the new movie, Crossing Delancey. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When Otis Williams started rounding up singers for his vocal groups, he felt like Yul Brynner in the Magnificent Seven. He had several groups, including Otis Williams and the Siberians, Otis Williams and the Distance, and the Primes. But the group he'll always be remembered for, the group that he's been singing with for over 25 years, is the Temptations. I've got sunshine. My Girl was the first Temptations song that made it to number one on both the R&B and pop charts. The Temptations were one of the most successful groups on the Motown record label. They had great voices, great harmonies, cool clothes, and flashy dance moves. Otis Williams kept the group going long after the departure of their lead singers, David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks. The Temptations have sung through the stylistic changes of the decades and even through the demise of Motown Records. Otis Williams has written an autobiography. It's titled Temptations. Welcome.
Thank you.
Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You point out in your group the Temptations were subtler and more romantic than a lot of the other guys, and that there was no sweating or grunting on the stage. So I want to ask you how you think that was reflected in your songs and in your style on stage.
Well, I think that Paul Williams, who was one of the original members, he always believed in us trying to convey selling sex as well as keeping the class. And I wish I could take credit for not sweating, but him and I especially were sweaters. But we always tried to do things in a top-notch fashion. And
well, you say in your book that you always thought about image. Even when you were in high school and you were
yes.
singing in the halls and singing at dances, you thought about image.
It's very important, you know, because when you're dealing with the public, it's always nice to set a very good impression. And we tried to do that with a very good image, a wholesome image and what have you. So that has always been one of our main criteria for trying to stay that kind of way because it's so important.
Berry Gordy, the head of Motown Records, liked your singing, liked your style, and finally signed you to Motown Records. Did he tell you once he took you in what he had in mind for the group, changes he wanted to make?
Not necessarily. Berry was more or less into the record end of it. You know, people like Charlie Atkins, Lon Fontaine, Maurice King, and Johnny Allen, they would be the guys that would polish and mold and refine as far as the stage and the image and things of that nature. Berry was very concerned about the record end of it. Now, not to say that he didn't care how we went out, you know, and looked because we were part of Motown and all under his auspices, but he was very into the creative end of it more so than anything else. And he left that up. That's why artist development came to be because of he knew that he had to have somebody that I got all these talented artists here, the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Martha and the Vandellas, the Miracles. Somebody needs to come in there and refine and polish them so we wouldn't be just like everybody else and knew how to get on and off the stage while we were on stage.
Now you said that Gordy really had more respect for producers and writers than he did for the performers. And I'd like to know what you meant by that, some examples of that.
Well, he had respect for the artists, but you know, like I said, being a creative person, you know, he was very into like songs because that's what he was really noted for, because he was a songwriter first, because he wrote songs for Jackie Wilson and Marv Johnson, Barrett Strong. And so I guess he was kind of partial to the producers and to the songwriters to make sure that whatever was being produced at Motown, it was done with the right kind of ingredient, with the right kind of song structure, which he always stressed, and make sure that the lyrics had meaning and where people could really identify and say, oh, yeah, I know what they're talking about. I've lived that. That's touched me before.
But in terms of the lack of power that the acts themselves sometimes had, you describe how if a group didn't show up in the studio on time for their recording date, he'd have another group come in and record the song.
That's true. We had that happen to us with Do You Love Me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not because of us not coming to the studio and knew that we had to be there. It was that this one particular day we were at St. Stephen's Community Church and watching the Dixie Hummingbirds and the Harmonizing Four, because we were very into gospel groups. And so the next day when we came up to the company, and they said, man, where were you guys? Mr. Gordy, he was looking for you all over town because he had to see a song for you guys. We said, well, we were at church. At church? And so we said, well, we were into spirituals, and we just had to watch those guys sing. He said, well, he gave the song to the Contours, and it was Do You Love Me.
I can't imagine the Temptations singing Do You Love Me. It's, you know, I know the Contours version so well.
Right.
Doesn't seem like the perfect song for the group. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know now, because he wanted to try it out on us, and I think it would have been designed for Paul Williams. We had the chance to do the song, but I think the record went to number two, and we were kind of jealous, but we were happy for the Contours as well, because we felt that our time would come.
Otis Williams is my guest, the founder of the Temptations. Now, the first song that you had that really made it onto the charts, that crossed over onto the charts, was the way you do the things you do. Now, this song was the result of a competition in-house, right?
Well, Barry always, like I stated in the book, he always had that competitiveness with his writers and his producers. You know, whoever would come up with the best product would get the release, and if they did it often enough, would get the most release, which would mean that you would make a lot of money. So Smokey had been writing, you know, and being very successful.
This is Smokey Robinson,
Smokey
who
Robinson.
Was your producer for
right,
a
and he
long
had
time.
Produced quite a few hits on Mary Wells. And when she left, that kind of opened up a little vacuum. So I guess he said, well, after writing My Guy, let me write My Girl. And so in 64, we recorded My Girl at the end of 64. And it was a big hit came February of 65.
Now, the way you do the things you do, Smokey Robinson also wrote that. Now, it's my understanding that there was a song competition of who would write. How did it work? Who would write the next song for the
Temptations?
Well,
that was later on. That was when Smokey had written Get Ready, and Norman Whitfield had written and produced Ain't Too Proud to Beg. So now we had a string of hits with Smokey, and Norman kept chipping away to the point that he really started coming up with very strong tracks, and he would have Eddie Holland of Holland Doja Holland to write the lyrics for him. So he really had a strong package there. So every Friday, Motown was noted for the thing of having a quality control meeting where they would bring all the material that was recorded that week. Well, that Friday, they would have like an evaluation of who would get the release and what did they think would be this and that and the yeas and nays. So with Smokey having so much success with us, Barry was kind of torn between, yeah, I like that Ain't Too Proud to Beg, but Smokey did have the hit on Ain't Too Proud to Beg. I mean, My Girl and Get Ready. So he said, here's what I do. If Get Ready, I'm going to go with Get Ready, and if it should go to the top 10, Smokey will get the next release. Now, if Get Ready didn't go to the top 10 nationally, Norman, you have the next release, because it Ain't Too Proud to Beg was so strong that it could not be denied any longer. So Get Ready must have gotten to the top 20. Didn't crack the top 10. And so Norman came in there with Ain't Too Proud to Beg, and we had 7 years of hit-making with Norman Whitfield.
Okay, well, I want to play The Way You Do the Things You Do.
That's a good one.
Okay, and this was written by Smokey Robinson?
Yes, Smokey Robinson and Bobby Rogers.
The lead singer on this is Eddie Kendricks?
Eddie Kendricks.
And let's give it a listen, then we'll talk about the vocal harmonies. Okay.
smile so bright. You know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight. You know you could have been a handle. The way you swept me off the feet. You know you could have been some perfume. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do,
the way you do the
all
things
day,
you do, the way you do the things you do,
as pretty as you are. You know you could have.
Otis Williams, which part were you singing on that record?
I was singing baritone. We would always sit around with Smokey, and Smokey was a very good producer in the respect of he would already have in mind how he wanted the harmonies to be structured, who would sing, what lead, and what have you. So it really was never no problem working with Smokey, because he would say, okay, we knew Melvin would sing bass. Eddie was on lead. Paul, he sang second tenor. David did first, and I was baritone.
Did you used to work out the harmonies before you joined Motown?
No, we all would pitch
in. You were doing together?
Yeah, because, you know, when you have five guys and everybody want their little voice to be heard about the creativeness, you would listen. And consequently, it would turn out to be very good, because like Richard, when we were the distance, he was good at sitting around the piano and picking out notes. So, you know, we all put our little 2 cents in.
You describe how some of the producers would have the singers sing slightly above their range.
Yes, yes. Motown was noted for recording their songs like a step higher, because they wanted the tension, the vocal dynamics, the stressing point, the pleading sound. So when you would hear it, you could say, oh, wow, I feel what he's saying, like pain in the voice. They didn't want you to sing too relaxed, because the song wouldn't come across with that emotional outlet, that meaning where you could really feel it. So they would always cut the tunes, especially Norman and Holland and Doja Holland, would cut it a step higher, because that's the way Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded. It was recorded just a key too high for David, but he was able to do it, but it was not without us having to stop the tape and let him rest, because he was straining his vocal cords and his glasses were sliding all off his face and sweat was popping off. But we were, you know, just saying, go ahead, David, you can do it, you can do it. And it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers.
Now, did you have to be above your range also?
No, I didn't do that much leading in the songs that I did sing lead on. It was in the key, because I'm more or less a ballad person rather than the driving kind.
Okay. Otis Williams is my guest, and he's written an autobiography about his life forming and then singing with the Temptations. It's called Temptations. You described a little bit the competition between songwriters about who would get to write the next song for the group. Was there competition between the groups? Did you have to compete, say, with the Four Tops over who would get the song that you wanted to do?
No, because Barry never let that happen. He would always let, okay, Holland and Doja had the Supremes and the Four Tops, even though we really like what they were doing, speaking of Holland and Doja Holland. But he said, no, you guys are having too much success with Smokey Robinson or Norman Whitfield. And then he didn't want all the songs to start sounding alike, you know. So he wanted to always make sure that there was that division, that separate kind of identity. And so he would never let that happen, whereas Holland and Doja would just do, you know, more than what they should have done, and the sound would have become too saturated.
We got to talk about your choreography.
Okay.
The choreography for your group was done by Charlie Atkins, who was a great dancer and got his start like years before he started working with vocal groups, dancing with Honey Coles. And
absolutely.
So describe some of the steps that he choreographed for the Temptations and the names for the steps, too.
Well, actually, Charlie, like you said, from the Charlie Atkins, Cole and Atkins vaudeville days. So we had checked him out a long time ago when he used to do Frankie Lyman, and he really did a wonderful job on the Cadillacs, because he brought the house down with the Cadillacs at the Fox Theater. And Charlie's steps, let me tell you something, not easy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, he's got a lot of little hitch steps and, you know, a lot of little subtle movements, and you really have to pay a lot of attention, you know, because you look at the stuff that we do on stage and say, oh, that's easy. Oh, no. I mean, he's cussed us out and called us all kind of names, you know, because it would be hard to get, you know. But once you got a Charlie Atkins choreography down, you would definitely be separate and apart from any of the other acts, because his stuff is so unique that, you know, you just knew you had captured something very special, because he's not an easy fella to deal with as far as his choreography.
You said there were no extra beats for corrections when he was choreographing one of your songs. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, you had to learn it right then and there, because let's say if you got out of step, you would catch hell getting back in, because it's a lot of little hit steps, and he's got everything scientifically in place. So if you missed that and had to come back in, you said, oh, my God, how am I going to catch back in? Because, you know, a lot of times choreography is to a certain kind of beat. Charlie would hear something that you would have to really strain to hear on the record, and he would probably pick up something like if it was a guitar lick. Well, most cases, steps are choreographed to the drum or bass lick. But he would get something that's all together, that's faint, that you would say, man, I don't even hear that. But it would be there. So if you didn't really grab hold of that and lost that step, it would take a minute to get back in. So it was very tedious in learning Charlie's routines. But like I said again, once you learn it, people would stand up and applaud, because it was something really unique.
Did you ever lose it on stage?
Oh, yeah. All of us at one time or another.
How would you cover up?
Oh, we'd cover up. But somewhere along the way, after a while, you say, oh, no, I got to get back in. So you would find a way to get back in. It was just something inside you said, you better find a way. So you would find a way, but it would be hard. You would miss a few bars before you got back in step. So we would cover it up. We would clown a little bit. Oh, I'm right back to the bandstand to do that, and then come back up and, oh, okay, I got it. Boop, and fall right in. But you would catch hell getting in for a while.
My guest is Otis Williams, and he's written an autobiography, and Otis Williams is the founder and leader of The Temptations. We'll hear more of their music and talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Otis Williams is my guest, and we're talking about founding and singing with The Temptations. And before we talk more about it, let's listen to another of The Temptations recordings. This is Since I Lost My Baby. You want to say anything about this before we hear it?
This is one of my all-time favorites, because the intro reminds me of a movie theme, because it's so big, you know, and I really love the intro as well as the song.
And tell us what to listen to for your voice on here.
I am singing second tenor on this here. I'm singing right under Eddie. One of the things about the Temps, we are noted for being able to sing many different parts. Sometimes I sing baritone, second tenor, first tenor, aside from lead and lead. Never bass. That's exclusive to Melvin.
Okay, here we go. Since I Lost My Baby.
Of light,
oh,
a new day is dawning, sunny and bright.
Oh,
but after I've been crying all night, the sun is cold and the new day seems old. Since I lost my baby,
since I lost my baby.
Singing and the children are playing. There's plenty of work and the bosses are paying. Not a sad word should a young heart be saying.
But fun is a bore
and with money I'm poor. Since I lost my baby.
That's The Temptations. My guest is Otis Williams, the founder and leader of the group. That's one of your many records that crossed over R&B charts and pop charts. Barry Gordy really wanted the group to cross over. He was really into crossing over.
Yes, yes.
So were there things that he thought you should do to make sure you crossed over to the pop charts?
Well, he always stressed the thing of, like I said, lyrics, you know, had a large play in it, and song structure. But he also stressed that the melody would be very simple, you know, whereas, you know, even a child could hum it. So he would stress as simple as you could keep it, the more mass appeal it would have.
Well, there's certain things you're supposed to do, like for the white listeners.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple for the white people.
Yeah, uh-huh. And for the black, but especially for, you know, that mass appeal. You know, just keep it like we said in the recording. I said it earlier today, and Joey and Suzanne, they died laughing. But when we are in the studio, sometimes you can get so sophisticated and kind of with putting certain things together. So when we get to that point, we said, no, just K-I-S-S. And that means, in our term, keep it simple, stupid. Because most cases, when you look at the top 10, records basically are very simplistic, you know, and they have that mass appeal.
Well, I got the impression that the idea was that record buyers should be able to sing along with the song, so you didn't want to do anything too complicated that we wouldn't be able to keep up with.
That was Barry's philosophy. That's it. You hit it dead on the head.
Let's talk about some of the problems with Motown and some of the problems within the group. When you signed your first contract with Motown, you were pretty young, in your teens or early 20s, I forget which.
Late teens, early 20s, yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that you shouldn't have signed that you did?
Well, at that time, you know, Motown being really the only game in town, so to speak, and we wanted to be there, you know. Barry had contracts that, let's say, now looking back on it, realizing the value of contracts and knowing the business like I do, those contracts weren't the best, you know. I mean, we were getting almost next to nothing in royalty rates and a 7-year contract, and they had everything. They took our name and all that stuff. So they weren't that great. They were geared for the protection of Motown, you know. So we signed it, and luckily, even though with those kind of contracts, we still made a large amount of money, you know. And so if they were like the contracts that we have today, my God, you know, it would have really even been better. But it was something that we had to grow to.
One of the problems internally in the group was when David Ruffin was doing a lot of the lead singing, you describe how he had a really big ego, and he wanted the group to be David Ruffin and the Temptations. He wanted his own limousine.
Yeah, well, he did have his own limousine, you know, because we, at the time, we had two limousines. David had his, then that was a group limousine. Then we had a station wagon, so it would be like a caravan of three when we travel. But there was a time that we had to meet down in Puerto Rico, and we had a meeting because he felt as though by him doing the lead, he should have it David Ruffin in the Temptations. So we all said, no, that couldn't be, because Eddie was singing lead, Paul was singing lead, Melvin was doing Old Man River, and my lead wasn't that much, but we just felt as though it should just stay that one word, Temptation. And so, yeah, ego, you know, we all had egos, I guess, with him being in the lead spot, you know, and, you know, being as fantastic as he, you know, is and was at that time, you know, he just felt as though he should have had that kind of, you know, distinction, and we just said no.
Well, he left the group. Then Eddie Kendricks, the falsetto lead singer,
right,
left the group as well. Were there any conflicts ever between them over who should get more leads?
Not that I can recall, because, like I said, by and large, during that time, Smokey was our producer, and Smokey would always have in his mind who he wanted to lead his song. So it never got to be that. And when we started working with Norman, Norman would most cases say, no, I want this and that guy. But then there were times we would say, hey, who would do it? But it never did get to be that kind of a conflict.
Let me play another Temptation song in which Eddie Kendricks and David Ruffin share the lead. This is You're My Everything.
You're My Everything.
Say something about it before.
That was one of the tunes that I sang first tenor on. And Eddie said, oh, man, you can go and do it, because I was more comfortable singing second tenor and baritone. But Eddie was getting ready to sing lead. And we were saying, well, okay, now, hey, Eddie, if you sing a lead, who's going to do the first tenor part? You. Me. I said, man, I can't sing that. He said, man, I hear you hitting those high notes in canon. You can do it, Otis. And we got down there, and I did do it. And I think, no, it was another tune, but I started to say Paul missed the part on that, but he was there. It was Born to Love You that Paul wasn't on. But I ended up singing first tenor. I think Paul was singing second tenor, and David was up over me, and Melvin on bass.
Let's give it a listen. You're My Everything.
You surely must know magic, girl, 'cause you changed my life. my dream is about you. Honey, I couldn't live without you.
Temptations singing You're My Everything. Otis Williams, the founder of the group, is my guest. You have kept the group together after the leaving of the lead singers through the decades, through the psychedelic period, through funk. Have you ever had another thought cross your mind of doing something besides singing with the Temptations?
Well, there's other things I want to do, you know, but first and foremost, I like doing what I'm doing, being a member of the Temps and the challenges that we have been faced with and being able to, ride them out, what have you. So I like what I do.
And just tell me, we only have a few seconds left. How is it different for you performing on stage now as a mature man as opposed to as a teenager and a young man when you started?
Well, it's not that much difference because you're still entertaining people, except they have grown with us. And, you see a lot of the new generation because when we were coming along in the 60s and those that were following us now, they have kids, so they're bringing their kids to come see us. So it's that kind of difference. But we still get the adrenaline flow from seeing so many happy faces, and sometimes they are crying tears of joy. So it's still that electrifying feeling of performing to people of the world over. So it's still great 28 years later.
Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Otis Williams, the founder of the Temptations, and they're still singing today. And he's written an autobiography. It's called Temptations. It's published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And on our next show, I'll speak with film director David Cronenberg. He brought us Men with Exploding Heads and Scanners, and a man metamorphosizing into a gory, pustulating creature in his remake of The Fly. Cronenberg's new film, Dead Ringers, is loosely based on the true story of identical twin gynecologists who both died from drug addiction. So I hope you can join us.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, 'cause you mean that much to me. Ain't you proud of that? And you know it. Please don't leave me, girl. Ain't you proud of me? Baby, baby, please don't leave me, girl. Now I've heard a crying man is half a man.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the new American immigrants and their new American dreams. We speak with writer Parity Mukherjee. Her new book, The Middleman and Other Stories, is about men and women from third world countries who come to America and hold on to their cultural identities while trying to make it in their new country. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new albums from country crossover artists Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Crossing Delancey, starring Amy Irving as a New Yorker who works in a bookstore, and Peter Riegert as her pickle salesman suitor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. With sustained winds of about 120 miles per hour, Hurricane Gilbert is raging through the Gulf of Mexico. Latest reports put the center of the storm about 340 miles southeast of Brownsville, Texas. Emergency preparations are underway from the Texas coast south to Tampico, Mexico. Earlier today, a plane load of Soviet weathermen briefly prevented the National Weather Service aircraft from entering Gilbert's observation zone. But now, the two sides are flying coordinated missions, sharing a hurricane that's big enough for both of them, as Rick Stone reports.
Early this morning, airborne researchers from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the Air Force were informed that a Soviet plane based at Camagüey, Cuba, had been given exclusive air rights to the only vantage point for observing Hurricane Gilbert. The NOAA plane was in the air already, according to Director Bob Sheets at the National Hurricane Center, and headed for its first look at the eye of the storm. For a time, the American weathermen were barred from the scene. According to Sheets, they got their data only by a daring low-altitude dash beneath the 3,500-foot level claimed by the Soviets. As the day progressed, it became a dispute among scientists rather than nations, and it was resolved. The Soviets remained at 12,000 feet, the U.S. Air Force at 10, and NOAA kept the premium altitude of 5,000 feet. First come, first served is the rule of international airspace. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
By a vote of 228 to 182, the House today voted to eliminate a controversial gun control provision from a major anti-drug bill. The losing measure would have required a 7-day waiting period for handgun purchases. The House instead approved a system still to be established that would identify convicted felons seeking to buy handguns. The substitution of the weaker provision was a major victory for the National Rifle Association, which lobbied intensely against the 7-day waiting period. Federal investigators today ruled out engine failure as the primary cause of the crash of a Delta Airlines jet last month. The investigators say there was no evidence the engine suffered a mechanical breakdown prior to the accident. The August 31st crash, as the Boeing 727 was attempting to take off from the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, killed 14 of the 108 people on board. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa today met for the second time with Poland's Minister of Internal Affairs. The session did not produce an agreement on the major issue at stake in the talks, legalization of the trade union Wałęsa represents. However, it did hold out hope of progress in future discussions. Jane Dobia reports from Warsaw.
Wałęsa himself didn't seem disheartened by the slow progress in today's talks. The key obstacle in the negotiations, however, remains solidarity itself and the form it might take if re-legalized. One member of the opposition in Warsaw said the government would never consider reactivating the union as the powerful social organization it was in 1980 and 81. Officials' hesitance to accept Solidarity as an organization with a broad populist base leads to the farther-reaching problem of political pluralism unresolved in Poland. Some members of the opposition are hoping Solidarity's re-legalization might pave the way for greater freedom of association, allowing individuals to form other independent organizations and even political clubs. But all those moves depend on the government's willingness to settle the key symbolic conflict, the nearly 7-year-long struggle over Solidarity's re-legalization. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
General Motors said today it's recalling about 30,000 vehicles due to various safety defects. All the recalls from the Detroit-based carmaker involve vehicles manufactured after 1985. GM officials said very few accidents have been attributed to the defects. Stock prices finished lower on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping 8 points to close at 2092.28. Declines led advances 7-5 on volume of 162 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Country crossover singers Randy Travis and Dwight Yoakam each have new albums, and rock critic Ken Tucker has reviews of both. Yoakam's is called Buenos Noches from a Lonely Room, and here's Travis from his called Old 8x10.
It's written in stone how I feel for you. It's written in stone what I want to do. Spend my life in the life hereafter loving you. And darling, if we live to be 100, or if we don't make it half that long, I want you to know what I feel for you is written in stone.
A year ago, I reviewed Randy Travis and Dwight Yoakam as hot newcomers who were going to shake up that capital of country conservatism, Nashville. Now, 12 months later, Travis and Yoakam are the establishment to a great degree. Their albums sell so much better than those of most country artists that Billboard magazine includes their records on its pop album chart. These guys are bestsellers in the same league as Van Halen or Huey Lewis and the News. But the question is, having made this commercial breakthrough, do their new albums extend their musical art, or do they just repeat the now established styles that first caught our attention?
I've had to buy back damn near everything I own from a little man whose name is Saul and has a lot of money to loan. I drive a beat up 67 Chevrolet, hey, hey. With a torn up seat, coat's brand new, holding my back near every day.
That's I Got You from Dwight Yoakam's Buenas Noches from a Lonely Room. It's a much darker, more brooding album than his previous record, and it's one that clarifies his position. Dwight Yoakam is the Raymond Chandler of country, writing elliptical, hard-boiled lyrics about death and despair, singing them in a clipped, almost curt manner. He pulls his cowboy hat way down over his forehead so that all you see of his eyes is an occasional flinty glare. He's living out some pop music version of a Clint Eastwood Western. All of this verges on self-parody, and in some respects, Buenas Noches from a Lonely Room is a ridiculous record. And at least once, it's an offensive one, when on the album's title song, Yoakam imagines hunting down a woman who left him for another man and shooting her with cold-blooded deliberation. Yoakam has fatuously claimed in interviews that the song is based on a real-life situation, minus the murderous climax, of course, and that will only add to his tough guy mystique. The most pleasurable music on this record, however, is a duet Yoakam sings with his boyhood idol, Buck Owens. Many of you may know Buck only from his time as the co-host of Hee Haw on TV, but please don't hold that against him. Owens used to be a fine record maker, and this song, called Streets of Bakersfield, reminds us of that.
I came here looking for something I couldn't find anywhere else. Hey, I'm not trying to be nobody, I just want a chance to be myself. I've spent 1,000 miles of coming. Yes, I've worn blisters on my heel, trying to find me something better here on the streets of Bakersfield. Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Say you care less how I feel, but how many of you that sit and judge me ever walk the streets of Bakersfield?
In contrast to Yoakam, Randy Travis is almost simple-mindedly unaffected. He's got a big, sleepy voice and big, sleepy eyes set in a small face that sits atop big, beefy shoulders. A quiet, reserved fellow, the most Travis's record company can squeeze out of him as a publicity angle is that he pumps iron after a concert instead of downing a few beers. Singing about true love and strong families, Travis is an even bigger star than Yoakam right now. He's a country achiever for the 30-something crowd.
Well, I've heard those city singers singing about how they can love deeper than the oceans, higher than the stars above. Well, I come from the country and I know I ain't seen it all, but I heard that ocean salty and the stars they sometimes fall. And that would not do justice to the way I feel for you, so I had to sing a song about all the things I knew. My love is deeper than the holler, stronger than the river, higher than the pine trees growing tall upon the hill. My love is purer than the snowflakes that fall honest as a robin on a springtime windowsill, and longer than the song of a whippoorwill.
Randy Travis's lockjaw howl is reminiscent of the country greats of a previous generation, George Jones, Merle Haggard, Webb Pierce. What's different about him and what's ultimately limiting about his music is the very fact that it is such a self-conscious throwback, so persistently an echo of a style rather than a new style, which was what Jones and Haggard and Pierce were exploring. This term is terribly overused, but Randy Travis really is a postmodern country star. He summons up the past and presents it to us as the future.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a little more Randy Travis.
Through the blue smoky haze, all through the days, troubles seem to melt away. My heart's on a roll, I'm easy in my soul. There's no hurry, no worry, things are going my way. My arms around my baby, shuffling on the floor. Cigarettes and sawdust, squeaky old screen door. Honky-tonk moon keeps shining on my baby and me.
This is Fresh Air. New immigrants from third world countries who are trying to establish new lives for themselves in the United States and Canada are the subjects of Bharati Mukherjee's stories. Her new collection is called The Middleman and Other Stories. Like the characters in her books, Mukherjee shares two cultures. She was born and raised in Calcutta, but came to the United States 25 years ago. One story from her new anthology is called The Tenant. It's about an Indian woman living in America who's looking to meet a suitable Indian man. She turns to the personal ads of an Indian newspaper.
She goes onto the stack of India abroads, reads through matrimonial columns, and steals an issue to take home. Indian men want Indian brides. Married Indian men want Indian mistresses. All over America, handsome, tall, fair, engineers, doctors, data processors, the new pioneers, cry their eerie love calls. Maya runs a finger down the first column. Her fingertip, dark with newsprint, stops at random. Hello, hi, yes, you are the one I'm looking for. You are the new emancipated Indo-American woman. You have a zest for life. You are at ease in the USA, and yet your ethics are rooted in Indian tradition. The man of your dreams has come. Yours truly is handsome, ear-nose-throat specialist, well-settled in Connecticut. Age is 41, but never married. Physically fit, sportsmanly, and strong. I adore idealism, poetry, beauty. I abhor smugness, passivity, caste system. Write with recent photo. Better still, call.
You use the phrase new pioneers in that passage. That's a phrase you also use, I think, in another story. Is that a common phrase now for a new kind of settler in America?
For the kinds of people that I'm writing about, I want to see my characters, my immigrants, as heroes for having had the gumption to pull themselves out of one culture and dreamed of a better life in another and done something about it, as opposed to the characters in, say, earlier generations of expatriate writers who came unwillingly, perhaps as indentured laborers to Trinidad and so on, and who therefore seemed to think of themselves as permanent or perpetual expatriates, outsiders, and who complain.
Let's talk about why you moved to America. You first came to the United States to study at the University of Iowa. Why did you come?
To be a writer. My father, who passed away a year and a half ago, was a real patriarch and a rich man who also was a patron of the arts, and he had three daughters, no sons, so that he lavished opportunities and indulgences on us. And his idea was that I would write novels in the way that perhaps other accomplished women do embroidery or indulge in flower arrangements.
Did your parents expect that after you'd studied at the University of Iowa at the Writers' Workshop, that then you'd go back to India and write novels there and kind of pick up on your old life?
Absolutely. My parents expected me to do the right thing, which to them was learn to be a writer and then go home and marry the man that they had picked out for me. But fate intervened. I met a writer who became my husband.
I want to quote something from your autobiographical novel, The Tiger's Daughter. And this is...
May I correct the tag autobiographical? I didn't know I was writing an autobiographical novel at the time. So while the character is not at all like me, I hope I'm smarter than Tara Banerjee, the lifestyle that I'm writing about is very much the lifestyle that I grew up in.
Well, let me read you this quote and see how it applies to you. This is about the woman who's now at a university in the United States. In school in India, she had not been permitted to think about sex. But now, realizing the girls identified her with the population explosion, the loop, vasectomies in railway stations, she blossomed into a bedside intellectual. I guess what I want to know there is, did you find yourself having to figure out how much experimenting you were going to do with new ethics and how much you were going to hold on to the ethics that you were brought up with?
I didn't spend much time thinking about what I was going to do. I just did. I'm an impulsive sort. What I did find out is that suddenly I was responsible for knowing about Indian population problems or about Indian poverty, that I had become a spokesperson for the whole country, if not the whole continent of Asia.
Well, that reminds me of something else, another issue that comes out in your new book of short stories, the predicament that someone is in when they've moved to the United States from another country and they've started to really understand the culture and become a part of it. And then a member of their family or a close friend comes from their home country and doesn't understand American culture at all. And the person who has been living in America has to explain it and kind of initiate them, and it's a very confusing enterprise. You have a wonderful section in your story called A Wife's Story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a woman who's living in the United States. Her husband, who's a big businessman in India, comes to visit. And he, of course, wants to go on a tour to like see the sights around Manhattan. And so they go on a tour together. Can you read that section?
The bus is crowded, and we have to sit across the aisle from each other. The tour guide begins his patter on 46th. He looks like an actor, his hair bleached and blow-dried. Up close, he must look middle-aged, but from where I sit, his skin is smooth and his cheeks faintly red. Welcome to the Big Apple, folks. The guide uses a microphone. Big Apple, that's what we native Manhattan degenerates call our city. Today, we have guests from 15 foreign countries and 6 states from this U.S. of A. That makes the Tourist Bureau real happy. And let me assure you that while we may be the richest city and the richest country in the world, it's okay to tip your charming and talented attendant. He laughs. Then he swings his hip out into the aisle and sings a song. And it's mighty fancy on old Delancey Street, you know. My husband looks irritable. The guide is, as expected, a good singer. The bloody man should be giving us histories of buildings we are passing, no? I pat his hand. The mood passes. He cranes his neck. Our window seats have both gone to Japanese. It's the tour of his life. Next to this, the quick business trips to Manchester and Glasgow pale. And tell me what street compares to Mott Street in July. The guide wants applause. He manages a derisive laugh from the Americans up front. He's working the aisles now. I could have been somebody, right? I could have been a star. 2 or 3 of us smile, those of us who recognize the parody. He catches my smile. The sun is on his harsh, bleached hair. Right, Your Highness? Look, we got a Maharini with us. Couldn't I have been a star? Right, I say, my voice coming out a squeal. I've been trained to adapt. What else can I say?
I really love that passage. When you started writing, after all, you came to the United States to learn more about writing, but when you started to write, were you not sure which culture you should be writing about, what the location of your story should be?
Not which culture I should be writing about, but the validity of one's material. I think the harshest legacy of post-colonialism is lack of self-confidence and feeling that your experiences, your cultural experiences, are somehow not worthwhile. I realize that one can, that a good writer makes interesting and makes important the alien material. And so, you know, I have tried to do that with my characters and my version of America.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bharati Mukherjee's new book, The Middleman and Other Stories, is published by Grove Press. This is Fresh Air. Time for a preview of All Things Considered with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
What's coming up?
Well, I have a conversation today with Jane Mayer, who is the author of an upcoming book called Landslide, The Unmaking of the President. In this book, there is the revelation that a high-level aide to former White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker recommended that Baker consider, in early 1987, invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Ronald Reagan from office. At the time, the aide, James Cannon, said Reagan was distracted and distressed over the Iran-Contra affair and that the White House was in a state of chaos. Also, we'll have more on Hurricane Gilbert today. The cost is one of the stories we'll be doing today. The belief is that some smaller companies who insure for hurricanes may go under.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Joan Micklin Silver's first feature film, Hester Street, was set on New York's Lower East Side at the turn of the century. Her new movie, Crossing Delancey, returns to the old neighborhood. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
I've noticed something curious over the last few years. My Jewish friends are having babies, and they're naming them Max. Max or Jake or Abe, that's what Jewish fathers with names like Steve and Bob and Mike are naming their sons. And what's at work here is a fascinating sort of backlash. The baby boom generation of Jews, the most fully assimilated in American history, is a generation whose parents would never have let their little boys be named something as purely garment district as Max. But this generation is waking up and saying, hey, my children have lost their heritage. It's time to de-assimilate a little. And that seems to be what Joan Micklin Silver's new movie, Crossing Delancey, is telling us too. Amy Irving plays Isabella, Izzy for short, who works in a literary New York bookstore, lives uptown, arranges readings, and visits her old Jewish grandmother on the Lower East Side. Izzy is smitten with the famous, dashing, Jerzy Kosinski-like novelist played by Jurin Krabbe, but Izzy's grandmother thinks she needs a husband, and she even goes so far as to hire a matchmaker named Mrs. Mandelbaum, who's played by Sylvia Miles in a deliciously over-the-top performance. The matchmaker comes up with Sam, a nice Jewish boy played by Peter Riegert. Is he glamorous? Not exactly. Actually, he's the local pickle seller. Here's how their first meeting goes, under the stern eyes of Grandma and Mrs. Mandelbaum.
Sam, what's the plan?
Well, I thought Saturday night, if you're free, I could take Isabel to dinner.
My cousin Mishka, the Romanian palace. He'll take good care of you.
Thank you, but I don't think so.
What's this?
It's been lovely meeting you, Sam, and I appreciate your kind invitation, but I don't think I want to go. Thank you very much.
Well, she spoke.
Amy Irving has a sweet, fawn-like screen presence, but she's always been a very actressy sort of actress, and she is here, too. Her performance doesn't have the shadings of ambition and moral quandary that would give it complexity, and so the movie has a big hole at its center. Peter Riegert is much better. He makes his character so low-key that we feel we're discovering his virtues by accident, even though the script is slamming them in our faces. In fact, this movie slams everything in our faces. It makes the uptown literary world look like a teeming viper pit, full of preening narcissists, waiting to prey on young innocents like Izzy. Meanwhile, the Lower East Side, where Sam and Grandma and Mrs. Mandelbaum reside, is a haven of wit and grace, sweetness and light. Crossing Delancey tells us that if you leave the old neighborhood and become assimilated, you'll wind up a lonely, aging single girl, swarming around the salad bars with all the other lonely, aging single girls. This movie has been compared with Moonstruck, and its superficial sweetness may appeal to a lot of people. But Crossing Delancey has none of Moonstruck's quirky wit or haywire energy, and its message is just the opposite. Moonstruck told us to aspire, take chances, make your world bigger, risk falling in love. Crossing Delancey has a much mingier moral. The world is mean and dangerous, this movie tells us. Better you should go home to Mama.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we answer the question, what's Mildred been up to since the conclusion of Remington Steele? And we meet actress Doris Roberts. Also, jazz pianist Dick Hyman performs and talks about the music of boogie-woogie pianist Jimmy Yancey and Mead Lux Lewis. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the stand-up act of comedian Joan Rivers. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.